Hello, and welcome to another episode of Good Timing with Isabel Hagen. I'm Isabel Hagen. And today, I want to talk a little bit about fear. Fear is tough. It's hard being afraid. I'm currently recording this in a closet. Closets are scary. It's like I'm in here all alone. Or am I? Anyway, the type of fear I really want to talk about is that fear I get when I really start doubting my ability at something. This happened a lot in the past with viola. I would have a bad performance or not win some competition, and I would get so afraid that I'd never been good enough, that maybe I've been bad all along, and anytime I thought I was good was just a delusion. And now I get it with my comedy and writing, too. Something doesn't go well, or I don't get an opportunity I was hoping to get, and I start doubting myself and getting really afraid for, like, the future, you know? And I think part of this doubt is useful because you don't want to just ignore when you don't get something or when a performance goes badly or not as well as you'd hoped. You want to take note of it so that you can try and improve for next time. But I could probably count on one hand, like, the amount of times I was able to successfully take note of a rejection or failure and not have it then shift into complete and total self-doubt in the process. Because that total self-doubt can be kind of like addictive in a way. It's alluring, almost. Like, maybe because, in a way, it's easier to just decide you're a complete and utter failure and there's nothing you can do rather than recognize that there's work to be done. Because I don't want to do work. That sucks. Anyway, I've been feeling this fear a lot lately, just this feeling of, what if I'm actually terrible at everything I do? And what if it never works out? Whether it's playing viola for some recording session or doing a self-tape audition or stand-up on Zoom. Well, stand-up on Zoom is just always going to be terrible. I just do that one because I'm like a masochist. But identifying the fear and almost personifying it helps me a lot. Like, just talking about it here makes me see that it's not grounded in reality. Or maybe it is. Maybe I'm just actually terrible. That's something I think about. Like, we talk so much about how we're too hard on ourselves, but it's possible to be awful at something. Like, someone out there is actually bad at what they do. And maybe that person is me. Maybe it's you. Probably not. This probably isn't helpful. I used to do a joke that was like, my mom always tells me I'm too harsh. I should go easy on myself. And I'm like, Mom, I do go easy on myself. That's why I suck. Is that funny? Anyway, I've got a great show for you this week. I talked to cellist Nick Kanellakis. Nick is an incredible top-rate cellist, just the creme de la creme. You know, he tours, he solos, he plays with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. You know, he's the real deal. But on top of all of that, and the real reason I was interested in having Nick on is that he also makes films and sketches and acts and writes, and that's something he's been doing for a while now, and we hadn't really talked ever before this podcast. We never really crossed paths except once at a party, but we knew all the same people, and I always loved these videos he did called Conversations with Nick Kanellakis, where he interviews very famous classical musicians like, you know, Itzhak Perlman and Emmanuel Axe, to name a few. And they're very funny, and you can find them on YouTube. Check them out. So I always admired Nick from afar and felt like we had a lot in common. And Nick recently made a short film that he wrote, directed, and acted in, and that involves him playing cello. It's great. It's called Thin Walls. You can watch it on Amazon. We discuss it briefly in the podcast, so you should watch it if you want to really know what we're talking about. Or listen to us talk about it and then watch it, and then you can be like, oh, I see what they were saying. Anyway, so I've always wanted to connect with Nick, and we talk about the different types of creativity that are involved with playing classical music versus filmmaking and all that good stuff. And for more on Nick, you can go to nicholaskanellakis.com. And before we get to the conversation, a reminder that if you have been enjoying this show and want to help out, please tell a friend about it or share it on social media. Go into Apple Podcasts and give it a rating and a review and hit subscribe. Or on another podcast app. I don't know. I only use Apple because I'm a sheep. Anyway, I really appreciate you listening. And without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Nick Kanellakis. But I think we met maybe once at a New Year's Eve party. I can't think if we've talked other than that.
So would that, at New Year's Eve, would that event, where was it?
Oh, who is that? It was like an apartment right near Juilliard. Some violinist.
Oh, Stefan Jakiv.
Yes, it was in Stefan Jakiv's apartment.
He used to have a lot of New Year's parties. I mean, maybe he still does and doesn't invite me, but he used to have a lot, yeah.
I was definitely a party crasher at that. I was not invited. I don't know Stefan. He probably has no idea who I am, but
no, that's not true. Everyone knows who you are. Yeah, he used to have a lot of parties, and that would have been a while ago because I don't think I've been to a New Year's party in a really long time.
Yeah, like, I've stopped trying to make New Year's a fun night because it's always disappointing.
It's horrible.
If you try.
It's really actually this was one of my favorite New Year's in a long time, I have to say, because I didn't feel compelled to do anything. It felt like the right thing to not do something for the first time.
Right. You Having know? A boring New Year's was the exact right thing to do. Yeah, exactly. I loved this New Year's. I was in New York for it. I was with my roommate. We did like nothing, and it was the best New Year's ever. But so how are you doing with the slowness right now as a performer? How are you feeling?
I've gotten used to it and then unused to it and then used to it again, and it kind of goes in waves like that.
Yeah, you know? I feel like it's kind of just how life is, but within the pandemic, like if life were normal, we'd also be going through these like ebbs and flows of
absolutely
down and up.
There's just a lot more ebb right now, I think. I
yes.
don't really know what ebb actually means, but I think there's more ebb, a lot more ebb, because you know, how have I been doing? I mean, there like some more, I haven't been completely without work, like, cause you know, if I feel like organizations sort of caught up to the times finally and started doing the online thing and the digital concerts or whatever you want to call them. Essentially videos. I mean, it's just videos, you know.
Right.
And so I've been doing some of those. They're not, they have their limitations for how fulfilling they feel.
Are you going into concert halls and just playing for an empty hall?
I've done a little of that, and I've done, or just big recording spaces like the Domena Center, things like that. Sometimes they've been live streamed, sometimes they've been just pre-recorded concerts. And those are my least favorite out of the pre-recorded concerts, because they're a very weird hybrid between a recording session and a live concert. You don't do nearly as much coverage and takes as you would in a recording session, but you also do a few and it's a little bit more than live, and it just feels extremely awkward in between.
Right. There's really no reason for either one. You're like, well, we could get more coverage, but it's supposed to be just like a concert. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Exactly. Exactly. But then you're like, oh, but this is going to be on the internet. Then I kind of like need it to sound better than this. So let's do another take.
Right.
You know? So those have been awkward. But have you done any of those?
No, I mean, I haven't even been in the position to turn anything like that down. But I think also like during this time, I realize like what I actually want to be doing even more clearly, because there's stuff I miss and stuff I don't miss. And
right,
I'm
right.
not like, why am I not being asked to do like live stream concerts? Like I'm fucking pissed.
Yeah.
Like I'm honestly like fine. But I am like doing stand up on Zoom, which is the worst thing ever, but I'm
right.
still willing to do it.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm,
yeah.
It's making it clear what I love. But, and I think, you know, I don't know if you feel this way, like you're sort of realizing what it is you really want to be spending your time on. now more than before? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think I already was going in that direction of knowing more clearly every year I get older what I want to spend my time on, even not regardless of the pandemic. I suppose the pandemic has, maybe that's helped clarify it, but I feel like I was already going in that direction anyway in my life.
Of like, and is the direction kind of like less music or just?
No, not necessarily. I mean, no, definitely knowing that, no, I wouldn't say less music, but knowing how, well, in the music field, knowing the type of work that I really love doing and that I want to do more of. And that doesn't mean that I'm not going to do, that I'm going to refuse, you know, work because it doesn't fit right into my lofty goal of the work that I'm going to do. Because at the end of the day, that's what happens when you choose a certain passion as your job, you know?
Right.
My job is to be a cellist. It's how I pay the rent. So it's never going to be, I don't think, only the exact things that I want to do, but at least just knowing, what direction I want to try to push myself, towards and the type of work I want to be doing and the type of people I want to be surrounding myself with. In terms of the stuff outside the cello, you know, I don't pay the rent in any form from any of my like filmmaking or acting or anything like that. So that has been purely for fun. And so it's not my job. And so it has the advantage in some ways of being fresher and feeling more, I wouldn't say more passionate, but, well, anyway, I'm sort of rambling, but as to your question about clarifying like what I want to be doing, for sure, I know that I want, that side of my life outside of music, the acting, filmmaking that I've had the bug for, honestly, since I was a child, but just didn't pursue that career path. I know now I want that to be in my life basically forever. In some form or another.
Why do you think when you were a child, you didn't pursue that and you did pursue the cello? Like, what do you think pulled you towards the cello?
Well, there are a lot of obvious things on paper. Like, I come from a musical family. Both parents, musicians, older sister, violinist, now conductor. It was just very natural. My dad was a conductor and had all these orchestras when I was little, and I was just exposed to it. And both my parents are so passionate about music, and just, it was just around me all the time. It just, and it's not like they forced me to do it. I wanted to from a very young age.
Yeah.
But I was just immersed in it and sort of fell in love with it. I mean, it's, you know, it's great stuff. It's a great art form.
yeah, it's good.
But like, you know, yeah, I think if I've wondered to myself, if I hadn't come from a musical family, would I maybe I still would have found music, but would I have at least tried out some other options a little more seriously? But you know, it's like, we all know as string players, right, that it's so kind of, if you really are even remotely serious about it, it's so all consuming. It's so difficult to play these instruments. It's so difficult to play them well. And then it's so difficult to play them well and try to make a career. You kind of do, at least at a young age, I feel, have to go 200%. You have to go kind of all out. And it seems very, I don't know if it's possible to be super diversified when you're young and expect to have some success.
Right. You really do have to have that like streamlined focus if you want anything real out of it. And I also, I mean, for me, I also come from a musical family, so it also made sense that I would pursue music. And it just, yeah, like I loved it. I didn't feel forced into it at all. But I think for me, I was more comfortable being like a violist who's like more of a team player and sort of in the mix. And I wasn't really ready to sort of have like the spotlight on me, which I think is what like doing comedy and that kind of thing lends itself to more.
Yeah, for sure.
So for me, I think it was also just like, I didn't have it in me yet to do more than just play the viola. And that was enough to consume me. But then there was like this shift, and I mean, I've always loved, and you said you've loved, you know, filmmaking and comedy since you were little, you had that bug.
Yeah.
There was sort of a shift for me in high school where all of a sudden I like noticed stand up and like the magic of it. And like that sort of seeped into my psyche and like, oh, maybe that's something in another life that I would do.
Mm-hmm.
Not thinking I would, but I don't know. When was it that you kind of like felt the actual drive to do something other than cello?
Like do it. I mean, I had the bug since when I was in college at Curtis, there was this, I made a movie basically when I was 20 called The Shining of the Curtis, which was this spoof of The Shining that instead of taking place in the Overlook Hotel, took place at the Curtis Institute, which is like this kind of haunted mansion type of place.
Right.
And it was for this like annual skit night that we did that I was the producer of that year. And I took so seriously. I took it way more seriously than any classwork, I think, than anyone had ever taken that annual skit night ever before. And I spent basically the entire fall semester making this 25-minute spoof of The Shining. So that was sort of, and so doing that was like, oh, this is one of the most fun, exhilarating things I've ever done. Probably the most fun thing I've ever done creatively up to this point. I got to do more of this. But then kind of like many years went by and I didn't. I just sort of, I knew that I wanted to, but I didn't. You know?
Well, in the same way that playing a string instrument is so all consuming, it also really lends itself to perfectionism. And I think being a perfectionist is really hard if you want to make films and things that have so many other elements involved. Like,
definitely.
You can be a perfectionist as a classical musician in a certain way because it's so focused and you can just go for that. But
yeah. I mean, I find I definitely am a perfectionist and that happens in my filmmaking too. And that's why filmmaking I'm learning more and more is just heartbreaking as anything else. I mean, it's an incredible thing, but it's also heartbreaking in the sense that like what you, there's a lot of sort of disappointment because it's so difficult to actually make a film, make it good and have it be what you kind of envisioned in your head. And it is so that's definitely, I would say the perfectionism that leads to pain exists both in the filmmaking world as well as it does in the music world.
But I think that's why so many people either want to be filmmakers or try to be filmmakers, because it is this beautiful marriage of kind of like all the different art forms together, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And it's really fun being a musician. And then like I've done some very small, minimal filmmaking myself. And like being a musician making films is really fun because you can like think about it in that musical context, but there are all these other elements, like, you know, obviously words and image and I don't know if you, when you edit your films, are you really like thinking like a musician or do you feel like it's a totally different thing?
I don't know if I think like a musician in the edit. I mean, I think like a musician when I add the music, obviously,
right,
and that's a big part of it. I mean, yes and no. I don't know if I literally am thinking, oh, I'm going to apply like my sense of rhythm to like the rhythm of the scene necessarily. But the cross relation between the arts has been very fascinating and to me. I mean, certainly between acting, honestly, less between editing films and music and between acting and music, I find there to be unbelievable parallels. When I first started, I got hooked up with this acting coach about 5 years ago in New York. And then I sort of a perfect situation, kind of unstructured thing where I could go see him whenever I did. He did these small group classes out of his apartment. And the thing that struck me right off the bat was what makes a great actor is so similar to what makes a really great musician, and particularly what makes a really great chamber musician, because the number one most important thing in both is listening. And the number one thing that seems to be lacking a lot of the time, ironically, is that very thing with certain musicians and actors. Because when you start to then focus just on yourself, you know, you can sort of get the job done in a certain way, but the greater the actor and the greater the musician, the more you can tell that how huge their ears are and how much they're actually listening to the people around them and then responding rather than just being self-conscious and focusing on themselves. And that was sort of the beginning of where I was like, wow, a lot of what I've learned as a musician can be applied. And now a lot, maybe what I'm learning as an actor can be applied back to who I am as a musician.
Yeah. Do you feel like maybe this is a stupid sort of which one is better, more question, but like, do you feel like acting has helped your music more, or do you feel like music has helped your acting more, or is it just an even sort of give and take from both?
I think acting, I don't know. I mean, probably both. I think what, you know, I've been in music for so long, and I'm much more of like, you know, an expert at whatever in music. I've been doing it since I was 7 years old. I'm acting is still like fresh and new, and I don't have one iota of the experience I have as a cellist. So I don't know if the, I think my acting coach told me early on that he felt that I wasn't coming in as a total beginner because I was using my background as a musician. I wasn't really conscious exactly of that necessarily, other than sort of obvious things like the performative side of it, you know, and that's very similar, just the way you like feel on a stage, the way you feel with another actor or musician and that kind of communication. But I would say in the beginning, what I remember really feeling like, oh, actually, I wonder, the acting is really gonna help me as a musician, or at least clarify a direction I'd already been kind of exploring, and now I want to go even further with it.
It kind of connects I feel like, you know, being a performer, however you are performing or making things, when you feel like you've explored multiple avenues, it can kind of like bring it all together a little more and make it feel like a more genuine expression.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I also think like being a beginner at something is so helpful. Like you said, you feel like you're an expert at the cello, obviously, and like acting is this new thing. And when I started doing comedy, like more than I think my like whatever musical training helped with stand-up, all of a sudden like being a beginner and like getting tangible results at something being new helped me with viola, because when you're like such an expert at something, you don't notice that you're getting better every day, and you can easily get kind of discouraged.
Definitely. Yeah. And then I kind of want to retract the word expert because it's ridiculous.
Well, the thing is, to most people, like, I mean, you're a soloist. You play with the Chamber Music Society of Link. Like to me, you're even like a step above me, but then to anyone listening who's not a musician, we're both experts, you know?
It's right.
I don't know. It's something else that's been interesting for me, like just getting to know more people outside of the classical music world and like relaying what I do, just seeing how people perceive what we do outside and how much we think about that is not thought about by like almost anyone else.
I know, I've been thinking a lot about that too. That's something I've been thinking about during the pandemic, like actually is what are the things that really don't matter anymore? Like there's a global pandemic, music is like dead right now. So do we need to really keep talking about Boeings? You know, like should we really still be discussing if it's like an accent or a sforzando, or, you know, like can we actually focus on the things that people actually care about, like communicating expression and like reaching people, you know, and like moving people, like that is so crucial right now. And I feel like that does get a little bit lost in our world in the classical music world. We get so caught up with the perfection of the intellectual side of the art, you know, because, you know, the putting these composers on pedestals and they should be, but sometimes I feel like we lose maybe some more important elements of what it's all really about.
Right. I love the discipline of it. I love the intense study that we get to do when we go to conservatory. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then you go play at like a nursing home and someone's like just clearly so enjoying it so much visibly. And you're like, oh, it wouldn't have mattered if I was like 10% worse at my instrument, whatever that would mean.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of like we think about all these things. Something that I always think about, sometimes I sub on Broadway shows, and I was subbing in Les Mis for a while. And it was always just kind of like, you know, it's a very long, tiresome show. You never feel like anyone's really listening. And then like at the end, I could see the front row stand up at the applause from where I was in the pit. And I'd always see at least one person like crying, like they just saw their favorite show.
Mm-hmm.
And it would always make me cry. And then I would feel like, oh, okay. Like, I feel like I was a part of something. And I forgot. Because the whole time I'm just like, this fucking show. I'm so tired. I hate this. And it became kind of like a drug. You know, I was like, at the end of every show, I was like, all right, give me a crier. Like, I need to feel some sort of connection here.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that for sure. Well, it's being a professional, though, right? It's like... Yeah, it's hard to maintain the perspective of that all the time when you're doing the grind.
Right, and I mean, it's a difficult thing to talk about because you don't want everyone to just stop caring about the details that we think about. If you want to pursue something, like, go 1,000%. Like, get as nitty-gritty as you can. You owe it to yourself and to the art form. But then there's, like, this balance of then putting that aside and also thinking about the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
I think, I don't know if you've experienced this at all with, like, you know, doing other art forms, but for me, I think that's why I got a little disenchanted with classical music after a while, is because I got too much involved. I like the big picture too much, and I realized I didn't care enough about the nitty gritty personally. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, maybe this isn't something that I need, that I should be, like, putting my whole hard into, because I clearly have these other interests and I like this sort of like doing stand up, you get this immediate response from the audience. And I was like, oh, I love this. It's just like, clearly I give you laugh and transaction complete. And it's so clear.
It's more visceral maybe. And I mean, it's, you know, comedy and I think film are easier for people to connect to audiences than music. Music is more abstract, and especially classical music. I think for me, I don't know if it was that I got tired of the nitty gritty. I'm actually not like, it's never been about attempting to change career paths necessarily. It's really just been like, I've just always loved filmmaking. It's kind of at least an equal passion, or close to it. And I just want to do it. I just want it to be a part of my life. And it's not necessarily because I am bothered by something in music. The only thing I will say is that as a cellist, let me make an addendum to that, which is that I do think what I have felt I was missing as a cellist is the full side of creativity, the 0 to 100 side of creativity, meaning creating something from nothing into something. You don't really do that as a performer, right? As a violist or a cellist, unless you're a composer. Playing the cello is a very, very creative thing to do, but I'm playing somebody else's music all the time, and I'm not a composer. And so I love it, but I did feel it wasn't enough for me creatively. It wasn't hitting enough marks for the creative impulses and desires that I have. So doing... actually, acting is kind of similar. If you're just an actor, it's kind of similar to being a cellist or a violist or something.
Right.
You're doing. But the idea of making a film is so intoxicating to me because it's so creative from the ground floor up.
Right. And I think of stand-up as kind of a microcosm of it, because you're also still, like, I wrote all of this and I'm performing it. Like, here is all of me. Yeah, it sounds like you don't have, like, a negative connotation to your... to the cello world at all. It was just like you wanted to add more to it, which I think is so great that you're able to.
I think so. I mean, look, when you're in a profession, there's lots of things I find negative and that I get bothered by and annoyed by. And it's when, like I said, like we were talking about before, it's when it's your job, it's not, you're not just doing it as a passion. You're also doing it as a job. And there's a lot of things that come with that, like doing it at times you don't want to do it. But I think for the most part, it's more about a love. It's more positive. It's more about a love of another art form than about, like, being not liking what I'm doing and wanting to find something else.
I think for me, it came from a little more of a negative place. Honestly, I can criticize the classical music world all I want, but it also comes from
a personal struggle where I dealt with like really crippling performance anxiety and just like never thought that anything went remotely how I wanted it to go, you know? And so that's more like my personal issue that I'm then maybe projecting onto the whole
Does the performance anxiety come into your comedy?
It works for the comedy because my hands can shake when I talk.
True, right.
And that's what it is. And I can take beta blockers and perform viola, but it's just felt like at a certain point, it's like, man, I can't do this thing without taking a fucking pill. Like, it just seems so like Frankensteined together. And like, by the time between not playing my own music and having to like, you know, drug myself, blockers are that intense. Like, you know, no shame to anyone. I take them. Like, it's no shame to anyone who has to take them, but it just feels more of a true, honest expression when I'm just like, you know, telling jokes that I wrote. And of course it's not always that bad. Like if I'm playing chamber music, I'm not as nervous if I'm playing solo, you know, like obviously I'm a working violist. Like it's still, I'm talking as if I've like quit viola for comedy.
Actually, I was wondering that about you. What is your balance these days? Let's say before the pandemic.
Yeah, before the pandemic, I was fully supporting myself playing gigs on the viola, you know, but it was a lot of recording sessions, subbing on Broadway, doing some tours with non-classical artists who needed strings, that kind of thing. Much more than like, I wasn't supporting myself playing all like classical music, like chamber music performances. I really think of myself as just like a violist for hire.
Gigging, essentially. Gigging.
Yeah, I'm a gigger. But I was, in terms of time spent, it was 50-50 with viola and stand-up and some other, you know, filmmaking projects.
Was the stand-up pulling in any income, or is it right now just on the side? Like,
had just started to, you know? And I did the Tonight Show the day before everything shut down. So it was like, you know,
I saw that. I was so, first of all, I thought you were great. I thought I was so impressed to see you up there, and just your set was great. And then I was also just like, wow, that was good timing. Speaking of good timing, like that was unbelievable.
It's funny. I talked to some people who are like, I feel so bad for you that you did it and then it shut down. And then people like you are like, thank God, you great timing. You did it right before the shutdown. Yeah. But I wanted to talk to you also about the short film that you made, because I thought it was so well done.
Thank you.
It's called Thin Walls. It's on Amazon. I'll plug it in the beginning too. But, you know, it's funny because I watched it, and at first it's like this very, not to like tell you what your movie is about, but I'll just tell you what I thought
about
it.
No, I'd love to hear what you need to tell me what it's about. I don't even know what it's about sometimes.
You know, at first it was like this very typical situation that musicians deal with, like, oh, the neighbors don't want me to practice. And it's kind of like, all right, like I know where this is going. But actually, to me, it was really a movie about writer's block. And I saw the cellist as a part of her story and her demons, and just this idea that, you know, the struggle is always going to be there. It always comes back. And I just thought it was like, obviously, like the story, if you just looked at it without projecting any meaning onto it, it was like an interesting, compelling story. But I also thought it was like a perfect metaphor for writer's block. And I just thought it was really well done, really concise. And then everything was just, so
I love that. I love that. That's an incredible interpretation, and I love hearing that. I mean, so are you suggesting that the cellist is actually kind of a personification of writer's block, that maybe he's not even real, or that kind of thing?
Yeah, because to me, I mean, not to insult the character, but he seems so like typical, like Bach is a genius, like I practice all day. Like, who is this guy? Like, I don't care about him. Right. He seems like a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
But like, so, I didn't feel bad for the cellist she was. I also didn't really feel bad for her. I mean, she also seemed like kind of just this disaster who can't get her shit together. And like, you know, it was sort of both ends of it. But I saw him as kind of almost a projection of her psyche and her inability to write.
I love that. Thank you. That is beautiful.
I don't know if that was what you were going for, but that's why I wanted to watch it again, because I was like, let me just like check this out again.
I love that. I don't know. You know, I the idea that I could make something that and I mean, not to get like pretentious, but like I love filmmakers like Charlie Kaufman, you know, who, or David Lynch, who don't, it actually is, it is, it's too simplified to just say, no, this is what it was. You know, I don't think they ever want, like, the idea that it could be read certain ways, different ways, is the highest compliment I could get, actually. I don't know if I did think about it that way, honestly, mm-hmm. but I love that that may have come across, you know? I mean, yeah. I think when I was writing it, no, these are two real people, and it's a power struggle between two artists on slightly, you know, caricature-ish, on verging on caricature. Yeah, this is a guy that practices way more than I ever could have dreamed to. Who is this guy? He lives by himself. Does he ever play concerts, or does he just practice all day? What is his deal? You know, or he's just like this specter, and then she's like, you know, the classic writer's block, and it's sort of, you know, and the irony of, I think for me, I really love your interpretation. I think when I was writing it, I was thinking more in the sense of two people. I mean, she's the protagonist, but that actually these are two people that are actually more similar than they realize, and that they are both kind of these lonely, cliched, lonely artist types who mm-hmm. who want to be something, and they kind of should connect and could connect, but they don't and can't, and it goes the exact opposite direction.
Right.
But they kind of should, but then the logistical, physical conflict prevents them from actually realizing that connection. I mean, that goes to like a maybe overly deep place for my little dark comedy, but that was sort of in the mix for me.
It can also be seen as an allegory for, you know, people trying to make it work in a relationship, and how a lot of times you just miss, or yeah. there's just like, you yes. know, some kind of like, well, this could work, but it doesn't for whatever reason.
Right. Exactly.
And that's something I relate to a lot as well. Yeah. I mean, well, people who are listening who haven't seen the film, probably like, what are you? But it's a short movie on Amazon. Yeah. Go check it out. You can see what we're talking about. But I also just thought like, the writing itself was really well done as well. And
thank you.
How long did it, like, what was the writing process for that?
So I spent about a year working on the script, and I was workshopping a lot with the lead actress in it, Ella, who's a good friend of mine, and she really helped me a lot with the writing process. And but yeah, I did, I don't know, I mean, probably over 100 different drafts over about a year.
Did you find it fun to just sort of keep chipping away at it?
I did. I love writing, and that's really helped during the pandemic, because I'm writing another screenplay right now. And I do love it. I was watching the Fran Lebowitz documentary. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, I've been watching that too.
Yeah. And something she said that really rubbed me the wrong way, which is that like, something about, like, you know, she only knows one writer who really loves writing.
Toni Morrison's the only writer she knew who loved to write.
Right.
Like, that's so...
But that felt like both... And, like, basically saying, like, if you're really good at something, you don't love it. And I was thinking, okay, well, there's some truth to that with the cello, but does that just mean I'm a really shitty writer because I really like writing? And I just didn't like that concept.
Yeah. I had the same reaction. I was like, oh, God, I love writing.
Yeah.
I guess I suck.
Right. That bothered me. But anyway, I've been really... It's been really fun, and I think I'm getting better, and the more I do it, and definitely writing this short, I've written stuff before, but writing this particular short film sort of energized the kind of love for writing.
Also, if you look up Fran Lebowitz, she's famous for just having like years long writer's block.
That's the ironic thing. Like, that doesn't doesn't seem like the best person to me. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I also find that when you're writing scripts, it's such an interesting process, because I'll write something and then I'll read it aloud with someone, and immediately I'm like, oh, that's garbage. Like, you have to like hear it out loud to know.
Absolutely.
And it's so, and then you also end up like cutting. I mean, whenever I edit something that I've shot, I cut out like half of the dialogue as well,
right.
Because you can't really write in, like, then there will be like a pause here where, I mean, you can, but the music of it like comes later. And so you overwrite to sort of fill in that.
Yeah,
that
I think that's good. I think that's good though. I think that's okay. I think yeah, you can chisel away in the writing. You can even chisel some of that fat down, so trim the fat a little bit in the writing. But there will still be things that absolutely are going to get cut from the final edit. I don't think that necessarily means that you should cut those, try to find those moments and cut them away earlier, like in the writing process, because I think by having them there, it informs the performance. It informs the actors, you know? And so then you're only gonna like cut a line if you happen to get what you wanted from a look instead. But if the line was never there, you may not get the look, I think. Right. Does that make sense?
But that's a really good point. Cause I often am writing to sort of, I'm like, oh, well, someone else is going to read this and think this is like overwritten or something. But so I tend to cut a lot, I think, even before I shoot. But that's a really good point that the line will actually inform other kind of stuff around it.
Yeah, because
it.
You can always cut it later. I mean, I don't know. I'm not that I'm, you know, I know that someone like Noah Baumbach likes to just really, really chisel away until the script is just word perfect. But I think a lot of other people have kind of bloated scripts, and then let see what happens after that, you know?
It makes sense that, you know, classical musicians or people who have been kind of like obsessive about one thing would then kind of need like a new fix almost.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I got like the rush of like, you know, practicing viola and like, ooh, I'm getting better and better like early on. Like I kind of got it out of my system and now I'm like just obsessively like pursuing some other stuff because I need like a new fix. I don't know if you feel that way about writing and.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, even like 4 years ago, my new fix was acting and right. I wasn't writing anything when I started acting and I was, it's sort of like the creative, the writing, directing part that's, and I'm still going to act in my stuff, but that definitely right now the juice is coming from the writing and the directing. No, I agree with you. And I never quite thought about it that way, what you said earlier about how it's like when you're more of a beginner at something, your rate of improvement is quicker. It's a steeper curve, right?
Right.
As a cellist and as a violist, when we've been doing it for this long, our rate of improvement, hopefully we still are improving, but it's like a lot more plateaued. Hopefully it's a tiny bit uphill, but yeah. Then when you're new for me, I felt like as an actor, every class I took, I was like, oh, I made another stride at this or that. And even as a writer, I feel like this bustling new kind of creativity and improvement happening.
Yeah, I'm so scared for the moment, which I hope never happens, where I become kind of disenchanted by stand-up and or writing, because
right.
I feel like right now it's really fueling me that it's still, I mean, I've been doing it for like, you know, 6 years or whatever, but it's still relatively new to viola. And it's almost like when you're in a relationship that's new and you're like, I know this is going to get old. And I'm so scared for that moment.
I mean, it probably will happen. I mean, I know, see, the solace that I've taken in those moments, which I have no doubt you've had as well, the moments, the questions that we ask ourselves, like, maybe I do want to try go more full out in a different profession, really change career paths, whatever. When I've had that question, the solace I take in staying where staying for the path I'm on is that if I were to try to actually make money as a director, let's say, I would have the same disappointment and slogging through projects I don't want to do and work I don't want to do as I've had as a cellist, right? It's only the fact that I'm not trying to make money or really become a director only that I'm able to do it just for fun and when I want, just when I feel passionate about it.
Right. It's like when you have those, I keep making allegories to relationships, but you know, when you have like a friend who you know you probably could date and it would be good, but it's like, it's so much better just being friends and like keeping that sort of percolation.
Yeah. I guess that's what they tell me anyway. But, I'm not sure I'm ready to subscribe to that just yet. But I definitely, I mean, the most obvious place is when I see my fellow actors, because for me, when I've acted or when I've, the few times I've actually auditioned, I just, it's just been like a fun experience for me. I don't really care right. that much. But you know how, I mean, you probably know some actors, like actors are miserable. They're so,
oh, it's the worst.
It's just like the worst profession. It's just rejection after rejection after rejection on a scale that no one else in any other profession has to deal with. Not even musicians.
I've started going for like auditions because I have reps through stand up, but then they put me up for acting stuff because that's what you do. And it's just, nothing's happened and I just never expect to get anything.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, I guess I'll make another fucking self tape that no one's going to.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine that being my only thing. Like,
right, exactly.
Thank God I have these other outlets. I don't really care. But right. like, yeah, actors, it's so tough.
Yeah. But I think about that if I ever, you know, that's the, I know for myself, one of the reasons filmmaking feels very fresh for me is because it is on the side. And that's just,
right.
that is kind of the nature, I think, of how these things work. When something becomes your actual job, and then you start putting that kind of pressure on it, it changes the nature of your passion in a certain way.
Right. And I do think that distinction of like calling something your job, it can also be really helpful for someone pursuing something, because if you remember that music or whatever your thing is your job, if it is your job, then these sort of grindy moments, these things that you don't want to do, it's like, well, it's a job. Like, no one wants to do their job 100%
exactly.
of the time.
Exactly.
And it can sort of keep you going rather than being like, I don't feel creatively fulfilled 100% of the time.
No, that's, like, that's not being an adult. That's being a child. Yeah.
But I definitely have some of that like childlike thing with me. And I never show it, but I'll be on some gig I don't want to be doing with viola, and I'll just be like, what is this? This isn't what I signed up for. And it's like, all right, Isabel,
you can think that inside all you want.
Yeah.
You know, the whole point, the whole thing of being a professional is like kind of like, you know, wanting to kill yourself inside but still getting the job done and doing it well, you know?
Yeah, that's what being an adult is. It's like getting out of bed every morning, even though you don't want to.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, but occasionally you have things that you want to get out of bed for, and that's the beauty of life.
For sure.
And this has been so nice talking to you.
Likewise,
Nick.
Likewise.
Yeah.
I'm glad to finally connect, other than at a New Year's party.
Yeah,
I didn't connect at the New Year's party.
We're probably like, oh, did you do something?
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, it was great talking to you, and we should collaborate on something at some point.
Totally.
Wherever and whenever that may be.
Yeah. When it organically happens, it'll happen.
Exactly.
Or we can push for a non-organic thing.
Exactly,
you know, I don't know what I'm saying anymore. Thank you for listening. For more, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter, both at @IsabelHagen_, and sign up for my mailing list at IsabelHagen.com. And as always, please rate and review the podcast. Thank you so much, and take care.